You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. I've long been an ardent fan of Francisco Goldman's work. I read his novel, The Long Night of White Chickens, years ago on a trip to Guatemala, and it made a very indelible impression. In fact, I thought it was kind of a wonderful coincidence that film director John Sayles is visiting Aloud this week on Thursday night, and he based his movie Men with Guns on a character in that same novel, and you were listening to that soundtrack when you came in. Francisco Goldman is also the author of two other great novels, The Divine Husband and The Ordinary Seaman. He has been the recipient of the Sue Kaufman Prize for First Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and Richard Ford enumerated his superb talents as a novelist: compassion, precision, muscularity, great thoroughness. Francisco Goldman began his career as a writer covering the 1980s wars in Central America for Harper's. His first nonfiction book, The Art of Political Murder, was the story of the murder investigation of a Guatemalan bishop with the twisting plot and colorful characters of a Graham Greene novel. In his new book, Say Her Name, Goldman brings the same compassion and precision and forensic honesty to his own experience as a bereaved husband. He has written an extraordinary testament to his late wife, Aura Estrada, who lives and breathes on the pages of this book, which is, as mentioned in the front page New York Times review, either an autobiographical novel or a fictionalized memoir. In either case, it is the heart-wrenching account of Goldman's marriage to Estrada, a young fiction writer who drowned in a body surfing accident in 2007 when she was 30. Francisco Goldman has established the Aura Estrada Prize in her memory, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that tonight. Francisco will be discussing his work with novelist Rachel Kushner. Rachel is the author of Telex from Cuba, which was a finalist for both the National Book Award in Fiction in 2008 and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and as well the winner of the California Booker Award. Telex from Cuba focuses on the Americans who lived in Cuba in the 50s and the various roles they played in the 1959 revolution. Rachel Kushner is the co-editor of Soft Targets Journal, and she's working on her second novel. Please join me in welcoming Francisco Goldman and Rachel Kushner to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Louise, for that great introduction, and all of you for coming. I love that muscularity line. It's like every male writer needs to hear that. we're gonna begin our conversation with just a really short reading from "Say Her Name." I'm gonna read just half a chapter. Then I guess later on in the event, I'll finish the chapter. Before Rachel and I, my good friend Rachel, I'm so happy to have this chance to talk with Rachel as a writer I admire so much. And for this chapter, I guess, as you know, this book is inspired by the death of Aura, who broke her neck body surfing on July 24th, 2007. For the bit I'm going to read, you just need to know about her that she was getting her PhD when we started going out at Columbia University in the Latin American, she was Spanish language department of literature. Though secretly she really wanted to be a writer, but I'm sure we'll talk about that and that whole part of. I guess when I refer to the UNAM, of course, that is the great public university in Mexico City. You know, it's like almost an independent Vatican-like city-state in Mexico City where Aura did her undergrad. And I think that's all you need to know for this. Aura was stuck in a broken elevator in Butler Library. She phoned me in her cell when I was at Wadley. There are other people in the elevator with her, someone urgently ringing the emergency bell, spritzing panic through the phone. I told Outer to stay calm, that surely it would be fixed within minutes, and to call me back as soon as it was. When after 15 minutes or so I hadn't heard from her, I phoned and there was no answer. Class was about to start. We were discussing The Street of Crocodiles, the book she'd have with her at the beach that final day. I didn't turn my phone off. About midway through, I told the students I had to make a call and stepped out. I got her voicemail and left a message asking her to let me know that she was okay. I pictured horrifying scenarios. Air running out, out of gasping, claustrophobic hysteria. Class was a disaster. When it was over and she still didn't answer, I phoned the Columbia switchboard, was transferred and put on hold until finally someone at campus security told me there had been no report of a stuck elevator at Butler Library that day. It was as if the elevator had vanished, with Auda and the others inside, and no one had noticed. Within seconds of her call to me, it turned out, the elevator glitch had fixed itself. The door had slid open, and Auda had proceeded directly into the reading room, where she was required to turn off her cell phone, and there she'd stayed studying for several hours, until finally she checked her emails, saw my frantic messages, and remembered. Or that time we had to go to a cocktail party in Manhattan. Auda was at home, and I was a few steps closer to Manhattan. Down in Dumbo, where I was subletting a friend's inexpensive writing studio for a few months. The plan was that she would take the F train to the York Street stop, find me waiting on the platform, and then we'd ride the next train into Manhattan. One train came, its doors opened, a few people got out, another pulled in several minutes later. The station, winter trapped inside, was a grimy cement and iron deep freezer. The payphones were broken. My cell phone didn't work down there. Robotic rats on the tracks, eating electricity and iron filings. How could this be happening? We timed it. I'd phoned her and said, "All right, I'm ready to go to the station." And she'd said, "Give me 5 more minutes." And so I'd waited 5 more minutes. She's still trying on clothes, I thought, pulling dresses on and taking them off because they're too sexy or too ostentatiously fashionable or because they show off her breasts too much or reveal her tattoo. She liked the way her most prized dresses, including some of the ones I'd bought for her, looked in the mirror. She just wouldn't wear them out of the apartment. 4 trains had passed. My fingers and feet stung from the cold. My nose was running. I climbed the long stairs out of the station to phone her from the street. I had to walk nearly a block before my phone regained its signal. Wind gusted off the East River, whirling litter like frozen bats. She didn't answer her cell at our telephone at home. I went back into the station, and as I descended the stairs, I heard coming from far below, like the crash of rough surf, the sound of a train entering or leaving the station. On the platform, looking into the tunnel, I saw the dwindling green lights and orange dot of a Manhattan-bound F train. What if she was on it? I waited another half hour, then climbed out onto the street again. I phoned the apartment where the party was, but she wasn't there either. That deja vu sensation of loneliness, bafflement, and sadness of, is this really happening? Then, I didn't know what else to do. I redescended into the station. If I described all of this to a psychoanalyst as a nightmare I'd had, wouldn't it seem to be about separation and death? What had happened, it turned out, was that Auda had gotten on the train at Carroll Gardens and ridden it only one stop, to Bergen Street, and had waited for me there. She'd confused Bergen with York Street, 2 stops farther on, or had spaced out when I told her the plan. Finally, she trudged back toward home, feeling as bewildered and sad as I was, and she stopped into Sweet Melissa for a hot chocolate. Arriving back from abroad to New York airports, We always had to join separate lines at U.S. Immigration, even after we were married, without in the much slower line for foreign visitors. I'd always clear passport control well before she did, then wait by the wall in front of where foreigners came out. Sometimes guards would tell me that I couldn't stand there, and I'd retreat to the luggage carousel. But often they left me alone, my unease stirring as the minutes passed, and still Auda hadn't appeared. Finally, I'd see her step up to one of the booths, and I'd feel a new stage of a surge of nerves, because what if there was something wrong with her papers again? Or her agent was in a bad mood, or just liked to harass Mexicans and turned her away on the slightest pretext. We'd all heard stories like that. Someone at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico had told Auda over the telephone that even her having a Fulbright scholarship was no guarantee of a student visa anymore. What if at any moment, here at the mouth of the gate, she was going to be pulled back and returned to Mexico without even being allowed to speak to me? I rarely got to spy on Auda from afar like that, watching as she obediently pressed her fingers down on the fingerprint scanner and answered questions, meeting the customs officer's eye, smiling or even laughing in response to some remark from him, or else remaining serious and composed. This always brought back memories of being a small boy watching my mother talking to a policeman who'd just given her a parking ticket, or to a bank teller, or to a butcher in Haymarket Square. My awareness of their awareness, of my mother's delicate prettiness and foreignness, my own sense of an unbreachable apartness. Until finally I saw the shrug of the officer's shoulder as he stamped her passport, and within seconds Auda was walking into my embrace. Moments of temporary separation and absence, and even loss, that were like little rehearsals for what was coming. Not premonition, but actual visitations. Death coming through its portal, taking Auda away, putting her back, receding back into its hole. Death, a subway train going the wrong way that you can't get off of because it makes no stops. No stopping for hot chocolate and death. That week after our first Christmas and New Year's together in Mexico, we took a room for 5 nights at a boutique hotel on the beach at Tulum. The first 3 mornings, we wound up having to drive from Tulum to the passport office in Cancun and back again in the afternoon, almost 100 miles each way. Auda had realized, before we left for the beach, that since arriving in Mexico a few weeks before, she'd lost her passport. Tia Lupe express-mailed Auda's birth certificate from Guanajuato to the FedEx office in Cancun. Mexican bureaucracy is notorious. Long lines stretching all the way back to the Aztec Empire. Multiple appointments to schedule at this teller window or that counter. Many official forms to buy at those tiny stationery stores, always owned by nice old ladies, to fill in, have notarized, then buy and fill in again because at one window some bureaucrat found one stupid infinitesimal thing filled out incorrectly, then re-notarize and so on. Auda was a veteran of Mexican bureaucracies, the UNAMs being among the worst. It was captivating to witness the unruffled manner with which she endured it all, her serene, polite, and even pleasant interactions with the clerks and secretaries, winning over even the most bristlingly petty or hostile ones. All this opened a window into her temperament, I thought. I loved waiting in those passport office lines with Auda, even though it was how we were spending our Tulum vacation instead of at the beach. That mostly two-lane highway that we spent so much of that brief vacation driving on, beaches and cenotes and ruins hidden from view, was like any ordinary highway, despite the billboards announcing resorts and water parks with Mayan names and motifs. Our rental car had a CD player, and at a gasoline station, because I told her I didn't really know his music, Auda bought a CD of Jose Jose's greatest hits. That was the only music we listened to in the long drives between Tulum and Cancun, the same sad ballads her mother had listened to in the terrible tower, weeping over her abandonment. On the Tulum-bound drive, we kept seeing small hand-painted signs directing us to Subway, which must be the name of a Mayan town, I deduced, pronouncing it Subway. I even said, maybe it says Subwaj, and we're not getting a good look at the signs. But no, it was a Y, not a J. For some mysterious reason, someone was trying to lure travelers to Subway. But it turned out to be Quintana Roo's first Subway sandwich franchise in a small shopping plaza off the highway by a golf club outside Tulum. Auda hardly ever again passed by a Subway anywhere in the world without remarking, "There's your Pueblo Maya, mi amor, Subway." To reach the beach where our hotel was, we'd turn off the highway onto a long stretch of dirt road, the car hitting the softer surface at nearly highway speed, bouncing and seeming to lift off and float through a brown cloud of churned up dirt as if riding one prolonged note of Jose Jose's sonorous voice. And that sense of dislocation again, of being propelled through a portal from an in-between world back into the beach town of Tulum. In the end, a bureaucrat at a window finally told Aura she could get her passport only in her state of permanent residence. Why wasn't she told that on the first day? There is no answer to that question. Thank you.
Hi. Hi, that was wonderful. Thanks. Thank you. For those who have not read the book, it is absolutely incredible reading experience. I've read it twice now, and I marvel each time. And it really is like, people say this, that a book is like nothing else that they've read before, but it truly is in many senses because it's its own genre of book. I think of it very much as a novel. No one can convince me otherwise. It is a novel. It has all of the artistry and strangeness and a kind of the fabulousness of a novel, and yet it cannot be detached from the inspiration of how it came into being. Sure. It cannot be detached from this real woman, Francisco's wife, Aura Estrada. So I thought maybe we could just begin with the facts of this novel's inception. So Aura died in July of 2007.
Yeah, Aura died July 25th. 2007, in the Hospital Los Angeles in Pedregal, Mexico City, after just a horrible, nightmarish 24 hours, which include that, it's in the book, the story of trying to get her from the beach out in Oaxaca, medevaced to a hospital in Mexico City. Those first 6 months after Auda died, are almost a blank. They were, you could imagine, right? I was drunk almost all the time, I spent a lot of them in Mexico. I think in the late fall, I finally went back to New York. And I think that whole period culminated, kind of. When I was at like 5 in the morning, or maybe 4:30 in the morning on Halloween night, I was hit by a car on 6th Avenue in the Village. And I think if I hadn't been so drunk, so floppy, I probably would have died. They thought in the hospital I was going to. They thought I was going to have a brain hemorrhage. And those 2 days in the hospital, it was kind of, when my friends in Mexico heard about this, one of them told me later, nobody was the least bit surprised. They have a saying in Mexico, pobrecito él anda al cuidado de Dios. It's like, it really shows that Mexicans don't have a lot of faith in God. Because if God wants to let him live, he'll live. If God's looking the other way, he won't, or whatever, right? I think when I came out of that hospital is when everything sort of began to change. I said, that was your chance, right? That was, you're going to live. And you have to try to live in a way that, wouldn't make out ashamed of you. And I think that's when the novel, I began to feel I've got to do this book. We were doing other things, right? The prize, we were starting to organize then, barely. And at Christmas, I just had to get out of my apartment. I didn't want to spend Christmas where we'd spent Christmas. And so a friend offered me an apartment in Berlin, and I took it. I'd never been to Berlin in my life, which made it perfect. you know. Right. And I went to Berlin over Christmas, and it was kind of perfect. You know, I was pretty lonely. I know a few people. It's a gray city. It's obviously a haunted city. There was this constant icy gray slush that was dribbling down from the sky while I was there. And I don't know, it just matched my mood. It was the sort of perfect match, you know, between writer and environment. And I just started to write. And I think that, you know, I always say, you know, if I'd been a mountain climber at this moment in my life, I would have said, now I have to go climb Mount Everest. Or if I'd been a river rafter, I'd say, I've got to go, you know, hit the Amazon or something. But I'm a writer, and my only way to process anything, to understand anything, to make anything, is to write. And so I just started writing, and that was the beginning of a 3-year, you know, effort.
I wonder if when you started to write, did people, friends perhaps, did they express any doubts to you in the sense of beginning a project while you're still very much inside the grieving process? I mean, in a sense, the book does go against a conventional wisdom.
Yeah.
And many writers cannot write out of grief, but you were able to do it. I mean, it's interesting. I didn't know that you had begun the book in Berlin, but I had expressed to you the other night this thought that I had when Francisco emailed me and said, I finished my book. I immediately thought of Albert Speer,
yeah,
who was in prison in Berlin. And he wrote these kind of, they're sort of well-known diaries later in life about this journey that he took around the world in his prison cell. And he ordered maps, and he took this walk very meticulously. And I have always had this thought that there are two kinds of people in the world. The people who would just let their spirit totally, you know, dissemble, and those who would walk around the world. And I thought, this Francisco really has it in him to do this and to write out of such grief. Did you know before you set out on this project that you had it in you to do such a thing?
I don't think I was thinking of it that way. I know that I know that it went against conventional wisdom, everything about this book did. My editor tried to help me and make me, you know, feel better about life, did offer me an advance. And of course I said no, I could never have taken money for this book. You know, I wasn't thinking of something I was going to publish necessarily. That, none of that was in my mind. But I had, the very day of Alda's funeral, you know, I found the note later. I had a little note. I'd written a little note where I made a few promises to her, you know, and I promised her that I would get a book of her writings published. You know, I promised her that we would found a literary prize in her honor. You know, you're just kind of crazy. You're just thinking, what can I do? And I did say, I am going to, you know, make a book, write a book so that everyone will know who you were and that people will know who we were and so that you won't be forgotten.
Right.
You know? And so, and I also, as I began to write it, I think I always had the idea because, you know, Auda was really brilliant. She was a brilliant writer. She has a brilliant imagination. She was a brilliant talent. And I really felt she was very exigent. She would have really been scornful of anything lazy or mediocre or sentimental. So I knew that I owed her the most rigorous, imaginative even, right, as within the amount of imagination you can allow yourself in a book like this. I used the word beautiful, beautiful book I could give her. And somehow that idea drove me, you know, and for those years. And I guess it was for me too, you know. I think when you lose somebody you love, you know, everyone has this fear of the enemy is memory, right? You know that someday you're going to forget. You know, it's just a matter of time before those beautiful little details, those little instances that the daily life of two lovers are made of, were going to begin to slip from your memory and lose that vibrancy. So everything was very, very present in my mind still. And I knew I had to get them down. You know, even with the idea that, you know, someday maybe, you know, I'll be, you know, an old man and I won't remember, you know, and I'll be able to open up this book and here it'll be. Was it that idea was sort of important to me.
Right. So the incident that you cite of sort of getting you started, or your wake up call, your chance, as you put it, of being run over essentially by a car, is also a point in the book that becomes a point of possibility in a way for speculation and fictions. It's from the little I know about it, I know that you were hit by a car and that you found yourself in the emergency room, but in the book, there is almost a sense of some humor to it, because you find there's a scene where an orderly is taking him, I think, in an elevator.
Yeah.
And he comes to, and the orderly says, "You might die, sir."
You might die, sir.
And
that's what he said. Yeah.
And then in the book, it's not clear what's happened to him. You don't know if he's been hit by a car. And then he mentions, the character Francisco Goldman, like the real Francisco Goldman, had written a book called Art of a Political Murder, and that there may be Guatemalan Secret Service after him. Or there may be relatives of Aura's roughing him up.
Well, this is totally paranoid. Yeah, it's like, well, they didn't know. You know, my good friend, I don't know if Sophie's here, Sophie's sister, Rebecca, she lives here in L.A., came, my very, very closest friend, came to sit with me in the hospital, and the policeman asked her, because they didn't know what had happened yet, and they asked her if I had any enemies. Because for all they knew, somebody had come and whacked me in the head, you know, with a steel pipe, or it might have been, you know, that's the night of the big gay parade in the village where I was hit, and it could have been gay bashers who thought, you know, I had gotten out of a cab with friends, I have to admit. I had lied to my friends, because my friends were... they're in the book. They were going. They had to catch a late train back to Princeton, and Aura's best friend and her fiance. And I said, oh, you know, I'll take the cab. I'll get off at West 4th Street. I'll take the F train home. But what I was really thinking was, maybe there's another bar open around there somewhere, you know. And that's the last thing I remember, stepping out of the car. So yeah. So I played with that. So that, you know, she told me that. I didn't remember. I didn't know what had happened. And then I guess I was hit by a teenage girl who thought she'd run me over, killed me maybe, and it told her dad. Her dad had made her call the police, you know. And but we were both guilty or innocent because, you know, I was so inebriated and whatever. She was, you know, so.
Right.
And so, yeah, in that little chapter, it's ludicrous. It's ridiculous. I talk about the shameless melodrama and embarrassment of that moment, yeah, and even the thoughts you have, could it have been, yeah, and my real life is woven all throughout.
You're wearing a morning suit that you had a tailor made for you because it's New Year's Eve in the book.
Yeah, it was very, that suit meant so much to me. Again, in my utter cluelessness, you know, those first days of being lost, you don't know what to do with yourself. And they were just so pathetic, but comically pathetic in a certain retrospect, because you just don't know what to do, you know. So I was constantly, okay, you know, I'll go sit in a church today. Today I'll go do Kaddish. I'll go to the Buddhist meditation place. I'll go get picture frames made. You don't know what to do. So I thought, I know I'm going to get a very heavy black mourning suit, and I'll wear this suit every day. And I called up a tailor. You know, I've never had a suit, my tailored suit. And he came, and he was this beautiful old man, very elegant old Mexican, you know, with a kind of sponge needle pin shaped like a rose in his lapel full of pins. And I said, I want this really black suit, maybe a really black suit. And he looked around the apartment, and which by this time I just had hung up photos of Aura everywhere. And he said, I can tell by looking at Aura that she was full of life. She would not want you going around showing such a heavy sadness to the world. Can I recommend a charcoal gray? It's lighter and it has some dignity. And he opens his book of fabric samples. And I said, okay. And so I just loved this. I was so proud of the suit. It was like my, and that night just to go see my friend. Yeah, and then the first thing I remember when I opened my eyes in the ambulance is they had these big garden shears. And they were just like cutting my suit right off of me. And that was that.
The end of the morning suit. So in terms of Aura's sense of play, I had wanted to ask you, the book ends, I want to ask you about the scene of her death next, which is the real, point of gravity and the end point of the book, and everything is leading up to it and circling around it. And then there's this sort of coda, as I think of it. The final chapter, Francisco goes to a psychoanalytic clinic outside of Paris called La Ferte. And it's a really incredible scene because you're not sure who the doctors and who the patients are. It's this kind of horizontal leveling as a form of treatment.
Well, it was based on Felix Guattari's.
The Laborde, right?
Laborde. It's based on Laborde. It is Laborde. Well, that's a lot. How do I start there? The book, that last scene, those are two separate things. That last scene, the whole book really, why? People always ask me, why does the death scene come at the end, right? Really, why is most of the book, you see the book. The book appears to move around in time, but it's actually quite structured, right? Essentially, the main arc of the book is Aura's life. And the narrator, who's me, much as I did, is sitting down and he's really set himself the task of telling her a life story. And he's going through all her notebooks, he's going through her diaries, and he really just wants to tell her story, like from beginning to end, while also telling the story of their love and his own story. With the idea, sort of, that the only way to understand what happened, not that you can ever understand it, but the only right way to narrate it is that somehow that moment where we're in the waves and I body surf a wave and then she body surfs a wave and the wave that she body surfs kills her, that somehow everything in our lives led to that moment. Right? I needed to see that. If this is a legal case, right, and somebody may or may not be guilty of a crime, or if it's just a crime of fate, everything is evidence. Every single thing that happened to either one of us somehow leads to that moment. And so that's why the book is about love, and that's why the book is about childhood, and that's why the book is about family. It's everything somehow leads to that moment. And then when you get to that moment, that was I was back in Berlin because I had a residence at the American Academy of Berlin. Oh boy, was that hard to write! I'll never forget it. I wrote it almost exactly a year ago. I think I finished it May 4th, May 5th, somewhere in there. I just never forget. My stomach ached, tears going down my face. I've never written like that before. It was really traumatic. And I remember it hit 10 o'clock at night. I'd been going at it for like 48 hours. And I was exhausted. And I said, if you go to sleep, this is too painful. If you go to sleep, you're not going to finish it. And so I drove on until about 3 in the morning, and I finished it.
Wow.
I had a ball of Pierre Dalmas mezcal that I'd brought from Mexico in my room. and I took it right, because the American Academy of Berlin is on Lake Wannsee, right on the shore, and I just took it down to the lake shore and drank like half of it. And then I didn't touch the book again till June. I basically let, the fellowship finished. I went back to Mexico City, and that's where I wrote the Lefert part. Now, the Lefert part is really interesting. And it's an important thing, because people ask, sometimes say, you know, why is this fiction, right? Obviously, and we could talk more about that later, but obviously the things about me and Auda are not made up. You know, there are some things in the book that had to be fictionalized, and we can get to that. But one thing that ran through the book always, I always imagined from the start that through the book I trace the novel Auda was working on, the last year of her life. And that novel was going to, part of that novel was going to take place in Labord. And Labord is this crazy, radical French psychoanalytic clinic founded by Félix Guattari and Jean Audry, based on completely out there egalitarian principles, so that in theory, the patients shouldn't be able to tell, you shouldn't be able to tell the patients apart from the psychoanalyst. So in fact, if you're in there, you might not know if you're talking to a shrink or another patient. And the place was completely crazy. And Auda just was in love with the idea of this place, right? And she'd been reading up on it. And Auda was like very brilliant, and she was going to do something amazing. And one of the main characters in her novel was this completely nuts French, Mexican, from Mexico, but who'd studied in France and become a Lacanian psychoanalyst. And very eccentric guy, and so that's where she was. Some of her book. And we always had this plan that we would go there, right? And she'd written to them, and we'd gotten this crazy letter back that we didn't know had been written by somebody,
an
inpatient or a psych. And believe it or not, I always laugh because everybody always thinks I know the part of the book that's fiction, the part that's set in Lefert. No, that's just how it was. I went there. I mean, I was so crazy myself. I still can't believe I did this. I went to France. I don't speak French. I went all the way out to this little town in the Loire. I went to the newspaper stand, and I tried to explain to the lady, asked the lady with my third grade French where I could get a taxi to the board. And there was a guy next to me, and he translated, and she said, "You don't need a taxi. Phone this number, and they will come and get you." And so I phoned the number, and I wait out front, and this van comes, and the van, like, has, like, they're taking some of the patients out for a Sunday, and they're sitting in the back. This one guy who looked just like William Burroughs, who's, like, staring at me. And I get in. And it's the Sunday stat. We're halfway to Labord, and this woman who's in front, who's an intern, was from Brazil. She turns around. She finally says, "We finally realized that we can communicate in Spanish." And she says, "So which patient are you coming to visit?" And I go, "No one." And she goes, "Well, why are you here? Why are you coming?" And I told her the story about how my wife and how we'd always planned to come, and she was left with the impression, because I said that we'd once received a letter from the board that maybe I knew Jean Henri, the leader, the director, but it was Sunday, they were off. So she finally said, "Well, we'll see if the person on duty, it'll be up to her, I can't decide." So we got there, and again, this misunderstanding, the person on duty also thought, on Sunday duty, they had the Sunday skeleton scaff, also thought that I must be friends with Jean Henri, which I'm not. She said, "Well, you can hang around." And so I spent all Sunday there until at nighttime. It was just amazing. It was as wonderful and eccentric as Auda could have imagined, you know? And
was it true that they had a folk singer performing between the hours of 4 a.m. and 6 a.m., which
the
was
folk,
based on
the folk singer
the
would
inmates,
come at like 2 in the morning on Saturday nights and sing till like 6, because that was the hour. The people who interned there get to make their own schedule. They get to help run the place. So they like, because I guess that's when their meds kick in just right. They like to have the folk singer from the village come at 2 in the morning and perform till like 6 in the morning. Great. And they have it's in this 18th century chateau, you know, in the old bar. And in the bar, they can use little tickets to buy drinks at the bar. But the bar are all like, you know, colored fruit syrup drinks and stuff. And, you know, they play bar. It's just crazy.
They didn't have any of your mezcal there. Do you want to read the second part?
If you want me to. You want me to read the second part? Okay, it's the second part of the same chapter. You know, and one thing we haven't really talked about yet that you know is how, and you begin to, by this time you know this about Aura, is that although Aura had every scholarship on earth, you know, she did not want to be an academic and was really, you know, forcing herself to do it. And partly she was there, partly out of parental pressure, partly out of pressures at a young age she'd put on herself to have, but she burned to be a fiction writer. And there's a key moment in the book where her thesis advisor, which really happened, said to her one day, because her department had kind of had a coup d'etat and had gone totally over into very kind of radical theory and cultural studies, which is fine, but it's just not, you know, what she was mostly into. And one day her thesis advisor said, oh, Aura, you're so innocent. We have to get rid of this naive love you have for literature. And that's the moment that did it for her. She came home and she said, I'm applying to MFA school. And, you know, she'd never written in English before, really, you know. And she had applied. She applied to Hunter MFA school, that wonderful program that's run by Peter Carey and Colin McCann, two of the best writers in the English language. And she got in. And it was like she had to put, doing this, she put all her scholarships at risk, right? Because they expect a full-time commission. She lived like a double agent that last year of her life, going to Columbia as a grad student, having to teach the four classes in Spanish every day to undergrads, doing her thesis defense, proposal defense, and doing the MFA. It was amazing. So that out is reflected a bit in this passage. You're going to hear. This is just the rest of this chapter, okay? Aura beside me in bed. What would happen to you, mi amor? Have I ever left you? I would die, mi amor. You know that. You would. I know you would die, wouldn't you? I really would. And she laughed with a kind of childish delight and said, or if something happened to me, if it was me. No, Aura. No, stop. If it was me who died, then I would die too. I would. Aura, don't even say that. You would die, wouldn't you? Ay, mi amor, sadly shaking her head. You are so lucky, Francisco, she would say. You're the luckiest man on earth to have a young, intelligent, talented wife who loves you the way I do. Do you know how lucky you are? I know, mi amor, I'm the luckiest guy alive. You are, Francisco, you really are. I am, I know. And if you're going to be a father at your age, you're going to have to keep yourself in top shape. Babies weigh a lot, you know, and you have to carry them everywhere. That's why I go to the gym so much. I'm getting ready. And you have to pay attention all the time to what's going on around us when we walk in the street. If neither of us is good at paying attention, then I'm not having a baby with you. I know, mi amor, I'll pay attention for both of us, I promise. Every day a ghostly ruin. Every day the ruin of the day that was supposed to have been. Every second on the clock clicking forward. Anything I do or see or think, all of it made of ashes and charred shards, the ruins of the future, the life we're going to live, the child we're going to have, the years we're going to spend together. It was as if that life had already occurred millennia ago, and a lost secret city deep in the jungle now crumbled into ruins, overgrown, its inhabitants extinguished, never discovered, their story never told by any human being outside it. A lost city with a lost name that only I remember, Subwe. On the 96th Street subway platform, where, after a late lunch at the Columbia Ollie's, we were waiting for the express back to Brooklyn, Aura was saying, oh, you know, it's a text That's about the way texts generate discourses among texts. So no reason even to mention authors or authorial intention. Well, okay, I know that's true, but when her class that afternoon, taken up by a discussion of Borges' short story, Pierre Menard, Autor del Quixote, no one had laughed even once. But Frank, she exclaimed. I always, Frank. It's really hard. The way she used to say that was amazing. But Frank, she exclaimed. No one had laughed even once. But Frank, she exclaimed. Didn't anybody realize that Borges was being funny when he wrote that story? The story's narrator, she recounted, is a mediocre critic who's indignant because his late friend, Pierre Menard, was left out of some catalog of important writers assembled by another critic. Okay, but does anyone else agree that Menard was so great? The Baroness and the Countess, they agree, said Aura, both of them friends of Menard and the critic. But they're just the Baroness and the Countess, she exclaimed. And the French Countess, she lives in Wichita or someplace like that now, married to a rich gringo. Don't you think that's a clue? A clue that Borges was also being silly and making fun of self-important bad writers? She mimicked a scolding, professorial basso. No, Aura, wrong. Silly, okay, bad writers? That's not how we read text here, Aura. The red and pink tassels of yarn, dangling like bunches of dwarf bananas, three on each side, from the Andean ear flaps of Aura's ridiculous pointy wool hat, and the spiky red tassel that crowned it jiggled in unison with her bobbing cheeks and the peal of her laughter. Aura was having fun, too, her eyes gleaming. She'd go on like this, chattery, ebullient, all the way back to Brooklyn. Aura was discovering in those days that she wasn't like the other grad students, ideologically prohibited from considering the person and mischief of the author. She wasn't always so giddy to revel in or acknowledge those differences. She was often tormented with worry. I'm going to be expelled. They're going to take away my scholarships. They're going to send me to the gulag. Do you think Jim has a wooden leg? She asked, switching the subject to one that lately had preoccupied her. Valentina's husband, Jim, the super rich investment banker, also quite a bit older than his wife. Hadn't I noticed? Wasn't that a wooden or prosthetic leg limp that Jim had? From the knee down, she said, his shin bone. His shunshin, what do you call it? What if she asked Valentina if Jim had a wooden leg, and it turned out that he didn't? Would she be offended? Valentina was already so insecure about how prematurely aged Jim looked that she wouldn't let him come anywhere near Columbia. Well, even if his shin is made of cheese, I said, it won't be just some ordinary camembert. That guy makes a ton of money. Ay, mi amor, she said sweetly. Que tonto eres. One night a few months later, coming out of a movie, we let ourselves lag behind Valentina and Jim on the sidewalk so that I could study his walk. Maybe he does, I thought. That summer, they invited us to their country house, and we went swimming. Arthritic stiffness was all it was. Waiting for the train to Brooklyn, listening, looking down into her face, so full of puppyish excitement and her own particular innocence. What was that innocence? What was Aura innocent of that I wasn't? Much past experience of failure and disappointment. Was love making me innocent again, wiping that history away? Aura was innocent of the power of her own gifts, and that, her innocent promise and humility, sometimes made her seem so fragile to me. At such moments, there on the subway platform, practically dizzy with love for her, I would sense how vulnerable she was, so caught up in her own excitement, not paying attention, so physically slight, to a shove from behind by some fiendish lunatic off his medication into the path of an oncoming train. This recurring fear of a crazed subway pusher was sometimes so strong that I would almost feel the urge to push her off the platform myself, as if the fiendish lunatic was me and I needed to get the inevitable over with. Or as if I just couldn't endure so much love and happiness one more second. And simultaneously, in a silent burst of panic, I'd pull her to safety, away from the edge of the platform. My hands are on her waist or on her shoulders. I would gently pull her back into the mass of waiting passengers and put my own body between her and the tracks and give her a relieved kiss on the cheek. I never understood it, this awful urge to push her off the subway platform while simultaneously pulling her to safety, rescuing her from phantom fiends, but also from myself. Thanks.
It's an amazing section of the book, and it warrants just one last question of mine, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. So there is definitely a sort of running current in the book of reflection upon cause and effect and fault. And I would have died in a freak accident. But you look into the ways in which your lives intertwined, and in a way, fault could be ascribed merely to having met her and known her. Yeah. And you say in another interview at one point that, in reference to Roberto Bolaño, who we all love, sort of said famously before he died that he wished he would have been a homicide detective. And, you know, he wrote the great 2666 with the incredible catalog of the investigation of the femicides in Juarez. And Francisco said, in reference to that, you said you would have been a prosecutor.
Yeah, well, that was one of, like you say, that's one of the lines that runs through this book. You know, in that last moment, I think that was last moment, there's a, you know, there's a lot of things there. And when he says, when I say, I never understood it, I mean I never understood it. You know, it's one of the, I've heard in other readings, other people have said this to me. They've had similar moments, that at the moment sometimes of most love, of most, you know, of just absolute, almost ecstasy of love, you know, you almost, I think there's this horrible anxiety that arrives at the same moment that it could end, right? Or almost as if though it's going to end, I have to end it, or almost perversely your mind does these things. And I think that all loves are always haunted a bit by the anxiety and fear of their demise, right? I think that's a part of love always. It's certainly, you know, and so that's somewhere embedded in that moment. But also, as you say, the theme of, you know, guilt. I opened the book with the quote from Waiting for Godot. You know, what should we repent? What are being born? You know, it's and I knew that this book, in a certain sense, I think deep down I admire homicide detectives even more than I admire prosecutors, but I couldn't say it. Bolaño already having said it. and when I was working on Art of Political Murder, though, I certainly was fascinated by the work of these very brave prosecutors, and I particularly was struck by how much in common they had, to a certain sense, with narrative writers and novelists, how to create, a good prosecutor knows that to create a convincing narrative of a crime, he really needs to rely on detail. The details are everything, right? And that's very, and the details have to have integrity, and they have to be credible, you know, to a very intuitive listener. And so in this case, as I told you, I saw everything. The book to me is almost like a prosecution case against myself, in which every single thing is evidence, right? Partly because I'm trying to understand myself. How could this have happened? Sure, you know, why did this happen? And also my own culpability. Is there a culpability? And is there existential culpability or real culpability? And of course you ask yourself these things. I think even if in her, you know, poor woman in her completely understandable frenzy of grief, you know, I was accused of being responsible by the mother. And that is a part of this book too, because in my own grief, that was a big thing. You know, it was awful to have these accusations leveled against you, and you couldn't help but internalize them, you know? And so as I was writing the book, sure, I was kind of waging the book as a prosecution of myself, right? In which our happiness counted too. You know, everything is part of the case. And then, you know, who's the jury? The reader, I guess.
You know. So without his mother, Juanita, who is very much a character in the book, did you ever feel that you were writing to her? Would you want her to read the book?
I don't know. I think that was the biggest challenge in the book, writing the mother.
Right. She was the person who accused him.
Yeah, it's
some people haven't read.
It's I knew that I could write with love about Auda, obviously. But you could not love Auda without understanding and being able to write about her incredibly intense relationship with her mom and her love for her mom. And I felt that, like, that I needed to understand that to write convincingly about Auda. And I also felt that that almost as an act of, I also felt I needed to find my own compassion for the mother, right? To understand her own reaction to what had happened. And I felt the book was going to, I always felt the book was going to succeed or fail to the degree in which I could convey out his love for her mother and find my own compassion for the mother. To me, that was the most challenging part of writing the book, you know? And if I didn't think I'd managed to do that, I don't think I would have published it.
Right.
And so I was very eager when the first people read it, you know? And I think my friend Jay might be here, and he said, you know, if anyone is defamed in this book, you know, it's going to be you bringing a case against yourself. You know, it's, you know, I felt that I had to, be extra hard on myself all the time in the book. And also, you know, it's, and so I think that, I don't think her mother would read the book. She has her Auda, and I think that she would certainly, see a version of her daughter in this book that people love.
Yeah.
You know, and I would hope that would be, give her, I don't know what solace there can be. I can't imagine a more terrible loss, you know, than hers. And if that would give her some solace someday, you know, good.
Mm. Yeah, beautifully put. So, it's 8:00, and I've been instructed to open up the floor for questions if people have them. And I just also wanted to say quickly, thank you, everyone, for coming, first of all. And secondly, these events are free because they are supported by the Los Angeles Public Library Foundation, which is a wonderful thing. And they have membership forms outside if people want to get involved in supporting their library. I urge you to do so. Are there any questions for Francisco? Yes.
You speak with a very deep psychological knowledge as well. Have you done that kind of work, internal work on yourself before becoming a writer or as part of becoming a writer?
That's really an interesting question. You know, it's I had never been to a shrink before in my life until this happened. I remember once being at a party in New York, and somebody for some reason said, is there anyone in this room who's never been to a shrink? And I think I was the only person who raised my hand. And they really became very important to me after this happened. That a friend's mother made me go to what they call in Mexico a tanatóloga, a grief specialist. And needless to say, that was super helpful to me. And, you know, one of the things about this book is I really had a crazy, difficult, you know, situation, right? I mean, at one point, I think I was writing about it. I was living it while I was writing about it. And that was one thing I wanted to do, is really get down on paper. This is not a self-help book about grief. You would never say to anybody, go do what he did, right? But I think people read it and go, this is how it can be. Right? At one point, I think my diagnosis actually, well, I mean, I don't mind telling you, right? It was extreme, major depressive disorder, situational, which means it was caused by a situation, not by your own chemistry, post-traumatic stress, and minor psychotic episodes. You know, and that's one of the, it's, what's one of the most fascinating things about grief is traumatic grief, is the way, you know, which is often, you know, caused often by very sudden violent, I'm sure some of you have been through it yourself or know people who have, right? Sudden violent loss, you know, to somebody you really, really loved. And they've shown how it really scars the brain. It literally scars the neural pathways. And that's one place where all those sort of trippy daytime hallucinations come from, you know, and also because you don't sleep. So you're going around dreaming into the day. And so all of this, and of course the experience of grief is very, I hate to say it, it's very narcissistic, right? You're constantly, you know, looking inside yourself, as you said. And then again, the question of psychological novel, right? I never thought I would do what people call a psychological novel. I'm not sure this is, but as you say, there's a lot, it's the mystery of personality is at the heart of this book. And I didn't understand exactly what I was doing till this summer when I read the Lydia Davis translation of Swan's Way. And I came on this fabulous sentence that explained everything to me, where he goes, for one thing that love and death have in common, aside from all those resemblances people are always talking about, is the way it makes us question more deeply, for fear that it will slip away from us, the mystery of personality. When I read that, that's it. That's what I've been doing. That's the whole book right there. You know, it's when you obviously when someone dies, you know, where did that person go? You know, what is a person? Right? They're not here anymore. You know, where do they live on? And when you're in love with somebody, why this one person out of every person on earth? Why is this person so fascinating to me that they fill my life? That, you know, I kind of wish I were them sometimes. They're more important to you than you yourself are. And you know, why this one personality? And then, as I said before too, you know, that sense of fragility that always is in love, that sense that it could end someday, you know. That's really fundamentally the question that the book explores. Absolutely that. Yeah.
Any more questions? Yes.
This may be very difficult to answer, but I'm wondering if in order for you to engage again in love, in our love again, do you have to put aura to the side?
Put an aura?
Have you thought of that?
Oh, I don't know. You know, that's interesting. You know, she's, you know, I don't know. You know, it's not that been that long ago, right? Not even quite 4 years. So it's, who knows what's going to happen. But she's in me, you know, I think any time a novelist spends 4-3 years, even on a made-up world, even in a fictionalized world, that world becomes a part of them, right? It becomes part of their interior. So imagine spending, I think this is one of the really good things about writing this book, spending 3 years trying to hear her voice, trying to hear that Frank, you know, just in everything else she used to say, and just keeping her inside me every day and trying to get her. I think that she really is even more part of me now, you know, than she would have been otherwise, right? And so, she still is my better half, you know, in so many ways. And I still, you know, I mean, it sounds a little corny, but it's not. I really do try to hope I can, make her live in a way that that I wouldn't embarrass her, you know, and which doesn't mean that sometimes I don't, you know, but so.
Yes. How about here, and then we have another question over here.
Hi, Frank. It's Sarah.
Sarah went to Hunter MFA with Aura.
I did.
Yeah.
And I don't have a question. I have a comment. But, you know, I haven't seen you in a few years, so I haven't gotten a chance to say this to you, and I want to say it in front of everybody. And it goes without saying, but I want to say it anyway, which is that I can't believe your courage to write this book. It's so amazing. And I just want to thank you for that. I want to say I bought the book the first day that it came out, and I haven't even had the courage to read it yet. So you can imagine just the amount, the courage to write it is something that I can't even fathom. And you're one of the bravest people that I've ever known. So thank you.
You're so sweet. Thank you. No, well, you have to read it.
Yeah, it's very hard to comment after her comment, you know. I wanted to ask you, it looks like the book is written backwards. She dies and then the book starts. How did you decide to go one way versus the other? You know, she could have died at the end of the book rather than the beginning.
Well, like I said, it's... you know, I decided to take to almost narrate the book as though, you know, I were the great all-seeing, as far as I could see, prosecutor of myself in some ways. And I wanted to see everything in our lives, everything in her life, you know, everything in my life as finally sort of culminating in that moment, right? And I actually used the line in the book, it's all evidence, right? And it's but I was surprised because everything, you know, every book, and especially something that makes something a novel rather than a work of journalism, is a book is really, the writing of a book is really a search for form. It's a very intuitive search. You're not writing to say, you know, in this chapter I want to make this point, and in this chapter I want to explain this thing, and in this chapter I want to tell grievers what to do with, you know, it's really musical, right? You're really trying to intuit the right way to tell the story, the right shape, the right pacing. You know, this goes here now because it feels right here. And then I was so, and in the end, the meaning of the book is the book itself. And I was so satisfied when a few people told me after among the first readers that the book really has the form of a wave. You know, that it builds and builds and builds and builds and builds. And then kind of the very peak is the wedding scene. Our wedding scene. And then it kind of starts to break, you know, in the way the story's told, kind of. And obviously, that's the wave in that narrative scheme, the wave itself, which destroys our lives and kills Aura, arrives, you know, with the wave itself in the narration. And then, the last chapter is almost like the foam, you know, spreading out over the beach, and we, you know, go, you know, so.
Okay, how about?
Shirt has had his hand up a while.
Oh, in the blue shirt in the center, and then on the side. Thank you.
Mr. Goldman, thank you so much for writing this book. It really is such a triumph in so many ways, and I really want to praise especially like how the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice is like mentioned through it. I really feel like I never knew Aura, but like she's so present like on the pages. And so it's such a triumph, I think, in that respect. My question to you is actually more like on a craft level. You mentioned like, you know, how you wanted to think of the book is like to think about it like in the future and like to remember her, like, you know, the little details. In terms of actually writing it, like what was like your, like did you, look, I know you mentioned like you looked at her journals and like her old computer files, but like I'm curious like how you put, I mean, in essence, like the whole relationship together, because it came together so beautifully in the book.
You know, that's just that process of you know, following a whisper, sort of, right, inside you. It's the tiniest moments sometimes, you know, that say the most. And just being very attentive and knowing that, you know, as a writer, you don't have to do scenes that accomplish a whole lot. You know, just a very quiet scene that revolves around a very small detail will speak to so much, and especially as they go accumulating, you begin to get a portrait of, and to let those details be the portrait, to not be in there trying to overinterpret, right? Except now and then when it's absolutely called for. I had this, and it's wonderful that you mentioned Orpheus, because, obviously that's one of the, I mean, in a way, this book is like, it goes, writing this kind of book goes back to the very roots of literature. The first literature was this kind of thing, you know, Orpheus going into Hades to bring back Eurydice, the Alcestis, right, going back into Hades. Plato himself, when he famously in the Republic is trying to say, why do we need poets? What are they good for? Right? And like the one, I think one of the few community, you know, ways in which poets are useful to the community, he says, is they provide a space for tears and lament. Right? And I think that idea, and I'll tell you the way, one idea that guided me through the whole writing of this book, this was like my muse during the writing of this book, is you see on the cover, you'll see the photograph of Auda's actual wedding dress, which is the dress, you'll see it's torn because she partied so hard that night. We danced to like dawn, and there was mud, it had rained, so it was mud, and you know, and she tore it, you know, and I had, during the whole writing of the book, I had it up there actually until a couple of months ago, the dress hanging over the mirror, and that dress, I thought of it as, in The Winter's Tale by Shakespeare, I thought of it as that statue of Hermione. You know, at the end of Winter's Tale, suddenly Hermione, the statue comes to life, and she's like, where have I been? And I just thought that if I could, you know, fill that dress, so to speak, with all the right details, all the right memories, all the right words, suddenly it would float down, sort of, and suddenly there should be one day, you know, in the middle of the room. I mean, that was kind of my operating muse image, you know.
So yeah, last question.
Mine isn't a question, it's just a comment. I didn't read your book, but I read the article in The New Yorker. And after I read that, I was so blown away by the intensity of your love and the flip side to your tragedy is that I felt was the joy that you, the fortunate moment that you met this woman and that you had with her the couple of years, and that a lot of people can't ever experience that, and that you are so fortunate to have met her and loved her and known her, and in that sense the tragedy, the loss and the love is incredible, and I applaud you for all of it.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, you know, I never feel more satisfied when I see, you know, some reviews and things, and the reviewers speak a bit as you have, and they especially talk about how much they love Auda, you know, and then I go, well, what could be better than that? You know,
so. Francisco and Rachel, I want to thank you so much. And before we end, though, I would love if you would just say a little about the Aura Estrada Prize and tell us what that is.
Yeah, this is, oh, thank you for bringing this up. You know, I think whenever there's a tragic death of a writer like this, it's almost the automatic reaction to say we will start a prize in her name. I was in no conditions to do it myself, but my friends really pulled together incredibly. Sarah among, you know, and all the whole Hunter family and all our close friends. And we managed to make this prize, the Aura Estrada Prize, Premio Aura Estrada. You can find it online easily. You can donate money. It goes to a female writer, 35 and under, Spanish language prose, She just has to be resident in North America, you know, Mexico, United States, Canada, Puerto Rico. And you get $10,000. A remarkable component of this prize is you get 4 residencies. So if you're a young writer, you could literally write 8 months without having to spend a penny. You know, you can go to a U-Cross in Wyoming, Ledig House outside of New York City, Santa Maddalena in Tuscany, and Hacienda Guadalupe in Oaxaca. And, you know, we've given it once in 2009, and we're about to give it for the second time. It's every 2 years, and we'll give it again this November. And also, if any of you read Spanish, Auda's book is phenomenal, right, that we've made of her scattered, you know, some of her writings into one volume. It's called Mis Días en Shanghai. And it's published by the wonderful Almadía Press in Mexico. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.